Welcome to the sixth edition of the St. Petersburg, Florida Area News Podcast for the year 2019. I'm your host, Joshua Black, and today we will cover the City Council meeting that took place on February 7th. When I entered the building around 8:40 a.m., there was still a line at the security checkpoint downstairs. This is unusual for a morning meeting. I found out why when I made it upstairs. But first, we must note that the Council passed both Consent Agenda A and Consent Agenda B unanimously, minus the items pulled by Councilmember Ed Montaneri, Council Vice Chair for this year. He pulled Item 5 from Agenda A and Item 10 from Agenda B. Actually, those pulled items passed unanimously too, but after a full report from staff and questions by Council. Oddly enough, though, for Consent Agenda Item A5, the cost to the city of $500,000 was not mentioned in the summary. It was mentioned in the staff report. Unless you had read the backup material, you may not have noticed that, except that Montaneri had pulled it to reports. All told, the consent agenda as passed spent $7.3 million without a debate or a report. But that's not what brought so many people out this morning. Remember that the Health, Energy Resiliency and Sustainability HERS Committee, the chair council member Darden Rice had made a big deal about trees, especially older trees, before she left in the middle of last meeting. All the people not obligated to jobs that morning who supported her position were taking turns at the podium during open forum, speaking in favor of more government regulations, including mandates for private property regarding trees. After they finished, the next item was regarding another downtown redevelopment proposal, this time for the southeast corner of the intersection of 3rd Avenue North and 5th Street, across the street from the Mirror Lake Library. The appeal of the city approval for the proposal drew 45 cards and a court reporter, likely because the city is being sued by the Bizu Project for their denial of its application for approval. The leading opponent for this project was the activist group Preserve the Burg, whose vision is to keep historically significant items from being replaced. The proposal involves the demolition of several older buildings which are used today as rentals to residential tenants on a month-to-month lease. The rent for these buildings is rather low, but not all 97 units are filled, though that may be because the owner made his plans to rebuild clear to the tenants last year. The reason for rebuilding it is to increase the number of units from 97 to 270, and the owner has designed the project to include commercial space on the street level. The project also does include 300 parking spaces inside the new structure. The Development Review Commission, also known as the DRC, approved the project 7-0 after several revisions. The appellant, Preserve the Burg, still objected, saying that the aesthetics were not in keeping with the surrounding neighborhood, the buildings should be preserved because of their historical status, and that the height of the project, 21 stories, is more suited for a property on the bay or on some vacant lot that doesn't have buildings already. Council members Gina Driscoll and Brandy Gabbard both complained that the rules for redevelopment did not allow them to vote in favor of the appeal. They stated that everything that they heard indicated that the developer had followed the rules in good faith, that they could not in good conscience vote against the project, even though they supported the views of the activists who had appealed. One sticking point for Driscoll was that the buildings in question had been up for demolition from 2005 to 2016. During the intervening time between 2016 and now, Preserve the Burg had made no effort to purchase the buildings and were unable to persuade the building owners to get them voluntarily designated as historical for preservation purposes. In a surprise to me and several observers, there were actually at least four people who spoke in favor of the project. One is an attorney for an elderly man in the Driftwood neighborhood whose sale of his home is on hold while he resides in a nursing home with failing health. The sale of his property would allow him to pay the high medical bills associated with the care he is receiving. The Driftwood preservation effort is scheduled for a quasi-judicial hearing on February 21st. In the end, the appeal failed 5-2, with only Rice and Steve Cornell voting to stop the project. Councilmember Amy Foster was absent all day, apparently attending to family. Cornell felt that the fact that the proposal didn't meet one of the criterion out of 16 should have forced another revision, and Rice lamented the loss of market-rate affordable housing in addition to agreeing with Cornell. However, Mayor Rick Kreisman noted that upholding the appeal to stop the project would likely result in yet another lawsuit that the city would likely lose in court. The legal team for the council seemed to agree. This quasi-judicial meeting took all of the morning and some of the afternoon. Council took 40 minutes for lunch, and after lunch, everyone from the gallery had disappeared. Remember the consultant that asked for $10,000 to study the juvenile auto theft trend in the city? In his quarterly report, Police Chief Anthony Holloway stated that juvenile auto theft is actually down sharply. Part of it is clearly because police are catching a few more of the thieves, most of whom are likely responsible for more than one burglary. Unfortunately, the standard practice is still to imprison the thieves, not to compel them to pay restitution to the victims. We'll get there someday. The police chief said they are still meeting their target for responding to true emergencies in under 7 minutes, but as the city grows, they may need to add more officers to maintain that level of service. However, it seems to me that most of the city's population growth isn't by annexation, but by increased density. It's not guaranteed that a higher population means more calls. Still, 7 minutes is a long time to wait if you have an intruder in your home or a gun in your face, and that's if you can get to the emergency button or a phone to make the call, which is the only way that police can know if you're in danger. Personal firearms are still the best line of defense. The report for the 40th Avenue Bridge was next. As promised in November, Brijesh and his team presented before council a contract for $468,320 to have part of the bridge replaced in preparation for closing the bridge entirely for 4 to 6 weeks. The final details for the bridge closure are still being worked out with FDOT. Thus, the bridge won't be closed for at least another 7 weeks because the engineering team wants to give residents 3 to 4 weeks' notice before they do that. The next item was the fire department seeking the approval of a separate contract to adjust the way calls are dispatched for medical emergencies in concert with other EMS services in Pinellas County. Basically, for calls that are deemed true emergencies, the fire department would still respond. For calls that are deemed lower-level emergencies, the fire department would still respond. For calls that aren't actual emergencies, the contracted ambulance service would respond alone. They usually follow up anyway. Personally, I don't think I like the ambulance service contracted for Pinellas County. When I had a medical episode, the paramedic treated me poorly, taping a IV PICC line over a burn I had suffered at work, and generally speaking tersely. Turned out I had an inflamed appendix, and I received emergency surgery, but he treated me like I was some habitual offender or something. Unfortunately, I didn't get his name, and this was back in 2012. I don't think that attitude could survive in the free market, but by law, these countywide contracts prohibit competition. Now, the union for the fire department is obviously opposed to this proposal because they believe that extra workload brought by increasing number of calls should be addressed by increasing the number of firefighters. Never mind that the vast majority of calls are traffic-related. Structure fires are more rare than ever before. Council decided to refer the matter to the March 28th Public Services and Infrastructure Committee meeting instead of acting immediately. Fire Chief Large complained that council didn't trust him and his colleagues enough. He felt that the simple presentation should have been enough to convince them to allow them to implement this separate agreement that doesn't affect the rest of the way the department interacts with the county 911 center. If he worked for a private corporation, he might have had that leeway. Unfortunately, he doesn't. Councilmember Gabbert noted that this item had inexplicably been moved to the consent agenda, as noted in the additions and deletions sheet, but had been moved back to reports without explanation. She was glad that that happened, but it makes me think that the fire chief who objected to the greater scrutiny had something to do with moving it from reports to consent. Again, he may have had the discretion he seeks were he working for a private company. Unfortunately, he doesn't. The next report was the solar co-op that the city has invested in as part of its sustainability initiative. There were a lot of efforts, a lot of sign-ups, a lot of smiles, no regrets for using force to prop up a particular industry. Favoritism is considered good when it produces a desired outcome. the Solar and Loan Energy Fund, which is also partially funded by the city, also gave its rather positive report. They've raised some private dollars, but not a lot. Councilmember Rice then gave the Tampa Bay Water Report. No significant changes were discussed and no council action was required. This was followed by the peer report, which came in parts. City has allocated $80 million in different phases and for different purposes to the demolition and rebuilding of the pier. This is $30 million in excess of the original $50 million and does not include money approved at the beginning of November for seawall improvements. These requests were to spend monies already allocated for the pier, not to request additional funds. But the development of a roundabout at Bayshore and 2nd Avenue Northeast will exceed funding levels unless they can find better options. So I guess we'll be over budgeted by close to $40 million by the time the project ends. That's almost double the cost and was easily predicted by yours truly when the project first began. I was a resident of Pinellas Park at the time, but I had friends here. Ironically, several of them have moved to Pinellas Park. The request for approval of funds disbursement also called for spending $300,000 to one artist for suspended art structure over the pier approach and $150,000 to another for an origami-inspired red pelican with two more realistically shaped red pelicans on its head. The smaller pelicans cost about $8,500 each. It was also noted that the tariffs on the aluminum forced the price up from $140,000 to $150,000. I just want to know why we're spending so much in taxes on out-of-town artists. The sewer report was next and included about $400,000 in disbursements. Claude Tankersley also noted that the city had 10 more unauthorized discharges, 9 being reclaimed water and 1 being actual sewage sludge. He didn't mention any expected fines, but you can count on the Department of Environmental Protection to issue them. Actually, before the second art project funding was approved, council shifted to a new business item, G7, on the additions and deletions notice. It was a resolution to urge the Pinellas County Commission to amend current code to lay more rules on dog and cat owners. The Bible does say that a righteous man cares for the lives of the beasts that he owns, but I'm not certain the rules proposed fully reflect that. Saying that pets can't be kept in kennels/pens or cages outdoors for more than 4 hours in the night seems excessive to me. The council passed it unanimously without a debate. Most of the rest of the new business items were referrals to committees, so I'll cover them as they come up on the calendar. The one item that wasn't involved renaming one stretch of 37th Street South Skyway Marina Boulevard. The group that led the effort said that they would pay for the new signage and that state law doesn't require fees for license updates caused by street name changes, so it too passed unanimously. That stretch is between 38th Avenue South and 54th Avenue South. Finally, it was time for committee reports, and Council Chair Charlie Gertis was ready to go home. I don't blame him. I think there were maybe one full hour's worth of breaks, including 40 minutes for lunch, 15 minutes during the quasi-judicial hearing, and 10 minutes another time. The meetings had started at 8:30 a.m., and this was around 6:45 p.m. Tyranny demands a high price, and these council members were paying it. To lessen the burden somewhat, Gertis requested that council members not read their full reports, but only move to have them received and filed unless there was an action required for council to take. The only report that required council action was from the Budget, Finance, and Taxation Committee, also known as BF&T, in approval for the $40,000 study to see if increasing fees on builders would increase funds for housing subsidies. It passed unanimously, unfortunately. The last committee report didn't pass without a hitch. A young man stood up to oppose his storefront conservation corridor plan, and this is what he had to say.
Hi, my name is Jason Spitzer. I'm a commercial real estate agent at RE/MAX Metro's downtown office, and I currently handle the property management and leasing for about 40,000 square feet of retail, restaurant, and office in the downtown core, half of which is located in the 5 and 600 block of Central Avenue. I'm speaking here today to speak out strongly against this plan, but not because of its intent or because of its end goal, which I support and applaud, but because I don't think that this proposal and plan is going to accomplish the goals it sets out to, because I believe that this is an extreme infringement on property rights, because I believe this is an unfair and unnecessary burden on small mom-and-pop landlords, and because I believe there's a potential unintended consequence of causing irreparable harm to our city and actually perpetuating the problems that this proposal seeks to correct. So I'd like to address what I believe the problems it doesn't address are, because there are a number of problems, and I think this is just a theory and practice problem, but the problems that small businesses and local businesses have in downtown St. Pete, first, is funding and financing, which this proposal does not address. The second is high rents. This proposal will do nothing to reduce the rents of current tenants, and it will not slow the growth of rent in downtown. Neither of those things are addressed in this proposal. So I want to tell you what this proposal will do. This proposal will make it harder for new restaurants to open in the downtown core or in the proposed corridor plan, which are majority locally owned, and also help to create us as a destination city. I believe this proposal is an extreme infringement on property rights, but that will be decided by the courts. I think it's an unnecessary and unfair burden on small mom and pop landlords. Landlords often get vilified in this town, and some of them are certainly big corporations only out for money, but I believe you look at the number of properties in this corridor plan that are owned and operated by small businesses, mom and pop landlords, I think you'd be astounded. And just as a kind of an example of my landlords that I represent, there's two of them, they've invested millions of dollars over the last decade and started doing so before we made any best or must visit lists. And they focus on the integrity of the block and also in the historic nature of these properties. So, and looking at the statistics of their tenants, 100% are small independent businesses, 95% are locally owned, and the vast majority, or the majority of which, have a diverse characteristic in some way or form. These are your ideal landlords. These are the people that you're seeking to punish with this proposal. And this is a burden in great economic times like we're in today, but my fear is in a recessionary time and hard times which are on the horizon. And I believe that burden will become devastating to these small mom and pop landlords, will prevent them from having the flexibility to pivot when they need to, which will cause vacancies, and then they'll sell to the highest bidder, which are out of town hedge funds and developers.
He made great points. Here's hoping the council listens. Speaking of listening, thank you for listening. Don't forget to review the council agenda for February 14th. We'll cover that in the prior committee meetings in our next episode. This has been St. Petersburg, Florida Area News, a production of the Reconstructionist Radio Network.